We all make little risk assessments every day, don't we? Like, is it raining too hard to walk the dog? Should I answer that unknown number?
Yeah, the small stuff.
But when we're talking about the big stuff, the things that could really, you know, throw our finances for a loop, are we as sharp as we need to be? Maybe not.
You're spot on.
Yeah.
And that's exactly why we've put together this deep dive just for you.
Right.
We've waded through a stack of insurance information. I mean, everything from the sneaky details in rental car agreements to the surprisingly complex world of insuring your home-based side gig, separating flood insurance fact from fiction, and a whole lot more.
Okay.
Our mission today is pretty simple. Pull out the most important, useful stuff, things that could genuinely save you money or, you know, keep you out of a sticky legal situation.
Exactly. No insurance mumbo jumbo here. Think of this as your fast track to feeling seriously clued in about protecting yourself.
Let's hope so.
So let's jump right into something almost everyone deals with. Renting a car. Okay, so that little $15 a day the rental company offers for damage coverage. Seems harmless, right?
Seems that way on the surface. But here's something to think about. If you were renting a car every single day,
okay,
that $15 would actually add up to, well, a whopping $5,475 a year.
Wow.
That's often more than folks pay for their own car insurance for the entire year.
Seriously?
Yeah. And the kicker, if you already have a personal auto policy, chances are you're already paying for this exact same kind of coverage.
You're kidding me. So my own car insurance often covers rental cars.
In most cases, yes. If you have physical damage coverage,
yep,
you know, collision or comprehensive on your own vehicles, that protection usually extends to rental cars here in the U.S.
Huh.
It's like a safety net you might not even know you have until you need it. And it gets even more interesting when we look back at how things used to work with older policies, like the family auto policy or FAP.
The FAP. What was the deal there with rental cars?
Well, back in the day with the FAP, if you rented a car, what they called a non-nouned vehicle, it was covered for physical damage as long as at least one of the cars you actually owned had that same coverage.
Okay.
And the way the deductible worked was pretty specific. If the rental car got damaged, you'd pay your own collision deductible first.
Right.
Then the FAP would step in and cover up to the deductible that the rental car company itself had on their policy, which was often around, say, $1,000 or
right,
maybe $2,500.
I see.
After that, the rental company's own insurance would take care of whatever was left.
So it was almost like having a backup for the rental company's deductible. But hold on, we tend to just think about scratching the paint or denting a fender, but there's more to it with rental cars, right?
Absolutely. Physical damage is just one piece of the puzzle. When you sign that rental agreement, you're taking on a much broader responsibility.
Like what?
You can be on the hook for things like the rental company losing out on money because the car can't be rented while it's being repaired. That's loss of use. You could also be responsible for the car being worth less after an accident diminished value. And then there are the towing fees, storage costs, and a whole bunch of other potential charges they can tack on.
Wow.
Believe it or not, you could even be responsible for some of these costs even if the accident wasn't your fault.
That's insane. So those waivers, they really push at the counter, the collision damage waiver or CDW or loss damage waiver, LDW. What exactly are we buying with those?
Essentially, those waivers are a way to transfer some or all of that financial responsibility back to the rental company.
Okay.
For example, Alamo's Maxi Waiver Saver, which is usually the priciest option, pretty much says don't worry about a thing. Their contract specifically states they'll cover all loss or damage to the vehicle.
So it's like an oops, I scratched it free pass?
Pretty much. At a cost, of course.
Now, National has a couple of LDW options, right? How do those stack up?
They do. National's standard loss damage waiver is similar to Alamo's Maxi Waiver Saver. It covers all loss or damage.
Yeah.
However, they also offer a loss damage waiver, too, and that's where it gets a bit trickier.
How so?
With LDW-2, National only covers the first $3,000 in damage, leaving you responsible for anything beyond that. So you really need to pay attention to which option you're selecting.
Definitely sounds like reading the fine print is crucial. And speaking of that, there's a story here that really drives home why understanding the exclusions in those rental agreements is so important, even if you do buy the CDW.
Oh, yeah. This is a real-world example that highlights the danger of not knowing what you're actually covered for.
Okay.
This person, on a business trip, rented a car and smartly added his coworker as a permitted driver, also purchasing the CDW.
Right. Seemed like the safe bet.
Exactly. However, after they both had a glass of wine at dinner, the coworker drove and caused significant damage.
Oh, no.
Despite having the CDW and the coworker being listed as a driver, the rental company refused to pay the claim.
Seriously, why would they do that? He bought the waiver.
Because the rental agreement had exclusions for damage caused by alcohol use and careless driving.
Ah, the exclusions.
Exactly. So even though the client paid extra for the damage waiver, it didn't protect them in this specific situation because of those exclusions. It really makes you wonder how many of us actually take the time to read and understand all the terms in those rental car contracts.
I'm guessing not many. It's always a rush at the counter. So what's the big takeaway for us, the renters, and maybe for insurance agents talking to their clients?
Well, for agents, the key is to proactively bring up rental car insurance with clients. Most people likely already have good coverage through their own auto policy.
Right.
Understanding that and knowing the limitations of those rental company waivers can save their clients a lot of money and prevent some nasty surprises down the road.
And for the listener?
For you, the listener, the message is check your own car insurance policy before automatically adding on the rental company's coverage. And always, always take a few minutes to read the fine print of that rental agreement, especially those exclusions.
Solid advice. Now, let's switch gears completely and talk about something else that often gets overlooked. The hidden risks of running a business from your home. You might be surprised by just how many people are doing this.
Oh, it's actually a huge number. Statistics show that around 1 in 10 Americans operate some kind of business right out of their homes.
Wow.
It's a real sign of entrepreneurship, but it also creates a lot of potential insurance blind spots for these folks.
And the numbers are pretty shocking, right? I saw that a large percentage of home-based businesses don't have any specific business insurance.
That's right. A recent survey indicated that a staggering 58% of home-based businesses don't carry separate business insurance.
58%.
Yeah. But here's the really surprising part. 87% of those uninsured business owners simply didn't realize they needed it.
That's a huge gap in understanding. It sounds like a lot of people are assuming their regular homeowner's policy will cover their business activities.
And that's a really dangerous assumption. Standard homeowners policies have several limitations and exclusions specifically designed to restrict or, you know, eliminate coverage for business-related losses, both for property and liability.
Okay, let's break down some of those limitations, starting with business property. Say someone is running a small workshop out of their detached garage. Would their homeowner's insurance cover damage to that garage?
Generally, no. The standard ISO H03 homeowners form typically excludes coverage for other structures, like a detached garage or shed, if any business is conducted in that structure.
Okay.
So if you're building furniture to sell out of your garage, that garage itself probably wouldn't be covered if a tree fell on it, for example.
What if they're not actually working in the outbuilding, but just using it to store business-related items, like inventory?
There's a bit of a nuance there.
Yeah.
The H03 form does have an exception for structures used solely to store business property owned by the insured or a tenant.
Okay.
As long as those stored items don't include liquid fuel.
Liquid fuel.
Yeah. So if a tutor keeps her workbooks and teaching materials in her shed, the shed itself would likely still be covered.
Got it.
However, if someone is running a landscaping business and storing gasoline for their mowers in that same shed, then coverage for the shed would likely be excluded.
Right.
There's another small exception for fuel in permanently installed tanks of vehicles or watercraft stored in the outbuilding, but the key is usually no loose liquid fuel for the business.
So what kind of business and what's being stored really makes a difference? Now, what about liability? If someone gets hurt because of your home-based business, are you covered under your homeowner's policy?
This is where the potential for a big problem really exists. The ISO H03 form has a very broad exclusion for bodily injury or property damage that arises out of or is connected in any way with a business.
Broad, huh?
Very. This applies whether the business is conducted on your property or somewhere else, and whether you own the business or not.
That sounds pretty airtight. Are there any situations where homeowners' liability would cover something related to a home-based business?
Yes, there are a couple of key exceptions. One is for what's called incidental office, professional, or service activities.
Okay, what does that mean?
It generally applies if you have a small office set up at home, you don't have clients or customers coming to your house, and crucially, you're not involved in retail, wholesale, or manufacturing.
So, like a writer or a consultant working from home alone.
Exactly. The other main exception is for volunteer activities where you're not getting paid, other than maybe being reimbursed for expenses. For example, if someone volunteers at a local charity and accidentally causes an injury while volunteering, their homeowner's policy would likely respond because it's not considered a business activity under the policy.
It's interesting how the courts have interpreted these rules around home-based businesses. There were a few court cases mentioned that really show how specific the details can be.
Yeah. What we see in these court cases is that determining whether something is a business versus a hobby really depends on the specific facts.
Like that hunting case?
Right. Esbury v. Indiana Union Mutt, INSCO. The court said a guy who occasionally sold animal skins from his hunting wasn't really running a business. It was more like a hobby because he didn't rely on it for income.
Okay.
But in another case, Mac v. Nationwide Mutt Fire Ends Company, the court said a musician's stolen equipment used for paid performances was definitely business property, and only the small business personal property limit in his homeowner's policy applied.
Right, a much lower limit.
Exactly. And then there's Gieslin v. Farmers Ends Company in Oklahoma, where the court said even selling a single puppy with the goal of making a profit counted as a business pursuit, even if no profit was actually made.
So the intention to make money seems to be a big factor, even if it's just a side gig. It really highlights that you can't just assume your homeowner's policy will cover you if you're doing anything with a profit motive from home.
Definitely not.
So what are the options for people who realize they have these gaps in their coverage?
Well, the most common solution is a home business insurance coverage endorsement, often called HOBI.
HOBD.
You can usually add this to your existing homeowner's policy, and it extends both property and liability coverage specifically for your home-based business.
What kind of things does it cover?
It can cover your business equipment, things like advertising injuries, and even liability related to your products or services. However, it's important to know that it typically doesn't cover professional liability, like errors and omissions insurance, if you're providing professional advice.
Right. E&O is usually separate.
For that, you'd likely need a separate policy.
I noticed there were also some more specific types of HOBZ endorsements mentioned.
Yes, there are endorsements like the Additional Insured Vendors Form, HO0751. This can provide liability coverage for people who sell or distribute your products for you. Think of someone selling cosmetics or nutritional supplements from home for a company like Amway.
Ah, okay.
There's also special coverage for valuable papers and records, HO0757, which can give broader all-risk coverage up to a certain limit for things like digital files or important documents related to your business, say, if you sell historical documents online.
Interesting.
And the American Association of Insurance Services, or AAS, has their own version of a home-based business endorsement with different categories for various types of home businesses, although the specifics weren't detailed.
What if your home-based business is too big for a homeowner's endorsement or doesn't quite fit, like higher revenue?
Yeah, for larger home-based businesses or those with higher revenue, maybe over $250,000 a year, as an example, the business owner's policy, or BOP, is often a better fit.
A BOP?
Yeah, it's a package policy designed specifically for small businesses, combining property and general liability coverage. There are usually rules around the size and revenue of the business to qualify, and certain higher risk types of businesses typically aren't eligible, things like restaurants or contractors, for instance.
So for insurance agents, it sounds like they really need to ask those specific questions about whether their clients are running any kind of business from home. It's not always obvious.
Absolutely. Agents need to go beyond just the standard homeowners and auto policy questions and proactively ask if their clients have any income-generating activities happening at their residence.
Dig a little deeper.
Exactly. Uncovering these activities is the first crucial step in making sure they have the right insurance protection in place. You can't just assume. Follow-up questions about the type of business, how much revenue it generates, whether they have employees or clients visiting their home. All important in guiding them to the appropriate coverage.
Right. Whether it's just an endorsement or a full BOP.
Precisely.
Makes perfect sense. Now, let's move on to another area where there seems to be a lot of confusion. Tenants' contents insurance. It's surprising how many renters don't have this.
It really is concerning. Studies show that over 64% of renters don't have homeowners insurance, or more accurately, contents insurance, Form HO4.
64%. That's a lot.
It is. And there are several common misconceptions that contribute to this lack of coverage.
Let's tackle some of those myths. The first one mentioned is that it's not necessary or it's too expensive. What's the reality?
The reality is that contents insurance for renters is incredibly important, and it's often much more affordable than people think.
Like how affordable?
Well, the example given was that the average premium can be less than what you'd spend on, say, 3 Venti Frappuccinos at Starbucks each month.
Okay, so pretty cheap.
Yeah, definitely manageable for most. And renters can often lower the cost even further by choosing a slightly higher deductible.
So definitely not a budget breaker for most people. What's the second big misconception?
The second myth is that the landlord's insurance covers the tenant's belongings. This is a really critical point of confusion.
I hear this one a lot.
Me too. The landlord's insurance policy only covers the physical building itself, any common areas, and the landlord's own liability. It absolutely does not cover the tenant's personal property.
Okay, so your furniture, your clothes, electronics.
Nope. If there's a fire or some other covered loss, the landlord's insurance won't help the tenant replace their furniture, clothes, electronics, or anything else they own. A renter's contents policy provides very similar personal property coverage to what you'd find in a standard homeowner's policy, like an HO3.
That's a really important distinction to make. And the third myth about college students.
Right. The third misconception is that older college students living off campus are still covered under their parents' homeowner's policy.
Not true.
Well, while that's often the case for younger students living in a dorm, it generally doesn't extend to older students living in their own apartments off campus. They typically need to get their own separate contents insurance policy.
Good to know. So for anyone renting, getting a contents insurance policy is a really smart and affordable way to protect their stuff.
Absolutely essential, I'd say.
Now, let's wade into another area that can be quite murky, flood insurance.
Ah, flood insurance.
Yeah.
Yes, this is a topic that's often misunderstood. And one of the biggest misconceptions is that a standard homeowner's policy will cover flood damage.
Which it doesn't.
It absolutely does not. It's essential to know that no standard unendorsed homeowner's policy in the United States automatically includes coverage for flood. Full stop.
And I think the way the media often talks about flood coverage, focusing maybe on the limits of the National Flood Insurance Program, or NFIP, that might unintentionally reinforce the idea of limited coverage overall.
That's a good point. While the NFIP is a very important provider of flood insurance, and often the only option in high-risk areas, it's important for consumers to realize that there are also several private insurance companies offering residential flood insurance.
Okay, private options too.
Yes. These can be an alternative to the NFIP, or they can provide additional coverage above and beyond the NFIP limits, what's often called excess flood coverage.
Interesting. Who are some of these private insurers? Are they big names?
Yeah, some of the companies mentioned as being involved in the private flood insurance market include ACE, AIG, Chubb, Fireman's Fund, Lexington, and Lloyd's of London. So yes, some major players.
And how do they operate differently from the NFIP? Well, unlike the NFIP, these private insurers carefully evaluate the risk for each individual property. They underwrite it, just like other insurance. And they aim to set rates that will cover claims and also allow them to make a profit.
So more traditional underwriting.
Exactly. However, it's important to understand that the specific terms, conditions, and even whether or not they offer coverage in a particular area can vary quite a bit from one private insurer to another. It's not standardized like the NFIP.
Okay.
And significant flood events like Superstorm Sandy have caused some private insurers to reevaluate their participation in the flood insurance market, or at least change their underwriting appetite.
Right.
But the key takeaway is that private flood insurance options do exist and can sometimes provide broader coverage and higher limits than the NFIP, which can be really important in protecting against potentially huge uncovered losses, especially for higher value homes.
What about the NFIP itself? Even though it gets some criticism, are there good resources there for consumers to learn about flood risk and coverage?
Absolutely. The NFIP website, floodsmart.gov, is actually a really valuable resource. People can find a lot of helpful information there to better understand their individual flood risk and what NFIP policies do and don't cover.
That's it.
And for both consumers and insurance professionals, the National Flood Insurance Program Summary of Coverage document is particularly helpful. It gives a clear and concise overview of the policy terms and conditions.
Nice.
And it even has a specific section that clarifies the often confusing topic of what's covered when you have flood damage in a basement. Which is usually not much for finished items.
Right. Basements are tricky with flood. Good to know there are accessible resources out there. While the financial challenges of the federal flood program are significant, it sounds like educating consumers is a more achievable goal we can work on.
Definitely. Closing that knowledge gap is huge.
Now let's shift our focus to something a bit different. The value you get from insurance that goes beyond just paying the premium. Thinking more broadly about risk.
Yeah, this is a really interesting evolution in how we think about insurance. For a long time, the focus was mainly on either transferring risk through insurance or deciding to handle the risk yourself, you know, retain it.
Right. Insure it or self-insure it.
Exactly. But now there's a growing understanding of the value in actively trying to prevent or reduce risks in the first place, risk avoidance or risk reduction.
And it seems like some insurance companies, particularly those that work with higher net worth clients, have really started offering extra risk management services beyond just selling a policy.
That's correct. While some insurers in the broader middle market might offer less extensive versions of these services, the companies focused on affluent individuals have made a real commitment to providing substantial risk management services. These can be quite comprehensive.
Give us some examples of what these kinds of services might look like. They sound pretty specialized.
They can be. Imagine living in an area prone to wildfires and knowing that your insurance company provides a private wildfire protection unit that will actively work to protect your home if a fire gets close. Deploying sprinklers, clearing brush, that sort of thing.
Wow, really?
Yeah, AIG Private Client Group was mentioned as a pioneer in offering this kind of service, and others have followed suit. Similarly, some insurers have developed hurricane protection units that offer services before and after a storm to help minimize potential damage, like boarding up windows or removing debris afterwards.
That's incredibly proactive. That's way beyond just paying a claim.
Exactly. It's about loss prevention.
What other kinds of value-added services are we seeing? Maybe for things like collectibles?
Yeah, for people who own valuable collections, art, wine, jewelry, you name it. Insurers often provide expert advice on how to best protect those items from loss or damage.
Like how?
This could include guidance on proper storage, ideal display conditions, secure shipping methods, and even security recommendations for the home. And even without these specific insurer-provided services. Something as simple as creating a detailed inventory of your home's contents, photos, videos, receipts, is a really valuable, yet often overlooked, risk management step everyone can take.
Good point. What about personal safety?
In terms of personal safety, some insurers offer access to experts who can assess your home security systems, conduct threat assessments related to things like kidnapping or extortion. PURE insurance was mentioned as an example here. They might provide access to advanced driving schools like the BMW programs and even offer technology to help prevent distracted driving.
It really highlights that insurance can be much more than just a piece of paper you file away.
It absolutely can be, especially in certain market segments.
But why do you think so many consumers tend to focus almost entirely on just the cost of insurance? It seems like that's the main advertising point.
That's a great question. And it likely has a lot to do with how our brains are wired. Behavioral finance talks about mental shortcuts, or heuristics, that we all use to make decisions. These shortcuts can sometimes lead us to focus on the most easily quantifiable aspect, which is often price, rather than fully considering the less tangible aspects, like the quality of coverage or the extra services offered.
Like easy comparisons.
Exactly. And advertisers are very good at tapping into these heuristics. Think about the Geico Gecko. It's memorable and focuses relentlessly on saving money.
Yeah.
Effectively steering our attention away from the more complex and arguably more important details of what the actual insurance policy covers. It's about the cost, not the worth, as the reading put it.
It's all about making a complex product seem simple, and price is an easy way to do that. So for insurance professionals who want to help their clients see the real value beyond just the premium, what are some key things they can do? 7 suggestions were offered.
Right, 7 good ones. First, start with the end in mind, like Stephen Covey said. Encourage clients to think about what they truly want their insurance to do for them in the event of a loss.
Focus on the outcome.
Exactly. Second, shift the conversation from just the premium to the actual claims experience. What happens when things go wrong? That's when the value shows up.
Good point.
Third, use plain, clear language. Avoid insurance jargon like ACV or extended replacement cost without explaining exactly what those mean in simple terms.
Yeah, cut the jargon.
Fourth, take the time to clearly document and explain the differences in coverage between various policy options. Don't just assume policies are the same.
Okay.
Fifth, really emphasize the importance of having adequate coverage limits. Being underinsured is a huge risk.
Crucial.
Sixth, offer more than just insurance. Make clients aware of non-insurance risk management strategies they can implement, like that home inventory we mentioned.
Right.
And ultimately, 7, aim to be a true risk manager or advisor for your clients, not just someone who sells them a policy.
That's a really insightful way to frame it, focusing on the value and the outcome, not just the price tag. Become a risk manager.
That's the goal.
Now, let's dive into another area that can be surprisingly complex. Condo insurance, or the HO6 policy.
Ah, yes, condo insurance. It has its own unique set of challenges because you're not just insuring your personal belongings. You're also dealing with your responsibility for the structure of your unit and, importantly, the shared areas of the condo association.
Okay, so what's the first hurdle?
One of the first things to understand is that the basic structural coverage in a standard HO6 policy, often called coverage A, is frequently inadequate. It might only provide around $1,000.
Only $1,000.
Often, yes, in the basic form. Which isn't nearly enough when you consider that as a unit owner, you're usually responsible for insuring things like your interior walls, flooring, cabinets, built-in fixtures, basically everything from the paint inward.
Right. It's more than just what you could pack up and move out. And what about loss assessments? I know those can be a big worry for condo owners.
Loss assessment coverage is absolutely critical for condo owners. And the standard HO6 policy often falls short in this area as well. Well, there are two main types of loss assessments to be aware of. First, there can be association-wide assessments. Like if a lawsuit against the condo association results in a judgment that exceeds their liability insurance limits.
Okay.
And the remaining cost is divided among all the unit owners.
Which?
Yeah. Second, there can be assessments against specific unit owners for losses that originate in their unit due to their negligence. Like a kitchen fire that damages the building, and the association charges back their master policy deductible, which can be quite high to that unit owner.
And the basic HO6 doesn't cover much for that.
A typical HO6 policy might only offer $1,000 of loss assessment coverage total. And even if you increase that limit with an endorsement, say to $25,000 or $50,000, coverage for deductible assessments is often still capped at that same low $1,000 limit under many standard endorsements.
That doesn't sound like nearly enough protection for some potential disasters. A $50,000 master policy deductible isn't uncommon these days.
It really isn't. Imagine a major storm, like a tornado or hurricane, damages the entire condo complex, and the association's insurance doesn't fully cover the cost of repairs. That shortfall could be assessed to all the unit owners, potentially meaning tens of thousands of dollars per unit.
Right.
Or think about a serious injury in the community pool that leads to a large lawsuit judgment against the association, again exceeding their limits. Those costs could be passed on to the individual unit owners.
So what are some concrete steps condo owners should take to make sure they have enough insurance? It sounds like they need to be really proactive.
Condo owners absolutely need to be proactive. First, get a copy of your condo association's master insurance policy and the condo bylaws or declaration. Carefully review them to understand their deductibles, liability limits, and exactly what property the association covers versus what you're responsible for.
Okay, step one, read the docs.
Yes. Second, understand exactly what your own HO6 policy covers in terms of structural elements within your unit, coverage A, your personal property, coverage C, and additional living expenses, coverage D, if you have to move out after a covered loss.
Know your own policy.
Third, consider increasing the coverage A structural coverage in your HO6 policy. You need enough to cover at least the master policy deductible, plus any upgrades you've made to the interior of your unit.
Makes sense.
Fourth, make sure your coverage C personal property limit is high enough to replace all of your belongings at today's prices replacement cost, not actual cash value.
Right.
Fifth, increase your coverage D, additional living expense coverage. If your building is heavily damaged, you can be displaced for a long time.
Good point.
Sixth, and this is crucial, increase your loss assessment coverage. Look for endorsements that provide higher limits specifically for deductible assessments as well as for uninsured or underinsured claims against the association. You might even want to consider a separate deductible buy-down policy if available. Seventh, assess your need for flood or earthquake coverage depending on your location. And if you do have those exposures, also consider purchasing earthquake loss assessment coverage.
Got it.
Eighth, buy adequate and consistent personal liability coverage on your HO6. Perhaps $500,000 is a starting point. And finally, number nine, strongly consider purchasing a personal umbrella policy. Make sure it extends coverage for things like serving on the condo association board as a volunteer director or officer, though umbrella policies typically only cover bodily injury, property damage, and personal injury liability, not financial mismanagement claims.
That's a really thorough checklist for anyone who owns a condo. Great advice. Now let's talk about how to close potential liability gaps with umbrella policies and your underlying coverage, maybe beyond the condo context.
Right. Umbrella policies provide that crucial extra layer of liability protection on top of your primary policies, like your auto and homeowners insurance. However, there can be situations where even your primary policies might not fully protect you, creating a gap the umbrella might need to fill or that needs a specific endorsement.
Like what kind of situations?
For instance, your personal auto or homeowner's policy might not provide liability coverage if you own, say, a trailer or a motorhome that's parked long-term at a campsite or on a lot you own, and someone gets injured or the property is damaged on that site.
But doesn't homeowner's liability cover you in a lot of situations, even off your main property?
It does. Your homeowner's liability coverage generally extends worldwide to your personal liability arising from places you rent for short periods, like vacation rentals or hotel rooms or even temporary campsites.
Okay.
It also typically covers vacant land you own or rent long term, as long as that land is truly vacant, meaning it doesn't have any structures like sheds, docks, or even that trailer or motorhome that you're using as a semi-permanent residence. Once you put something there, it might not be considered vacant anymore.
So what's the fix for those long-term parked vehicles? Or if you start building on that vacant land, how do you cover that liability?
The good news is that it's often a relatively inexpensive solution. For a small additional premium, the reading suggested maybe around $20 a year for your homeowner's policy and another $10 per $1 million of coverage for your umbrella.
Pretty cheap.
Yeah. You can often add an endorsement to cover the liability arising from those owned vacant seasonal lots, even before you start building anything or parking anything semi-permanently.
So add it right away.
It's a smart move to add that coverage as soon as you buy the land, because people often start adding structures or moving things onto the property without immediately thinking to update their insurance agent. Better to be protected from the get-go.
That makes sense. Better to be protected from the start. What else should we keep in mind when it comes to umbrella policies generally? How do you choose a good one?
When you're looking at umbrella policies, aim for one that offers broad coverage and has the fewest exclusions.
Fewer exclusions is better.
Definitely. It's a good idea to ask for a sample policy so you can carefully review the exclusions and understand what situations might not be covered. If you find an exclusion that concerns, you say, for volunteer activities or certain recreational vehicles, ask your agent if other umbrella insurance companies they work with offer coverage for that specific type of situation.
Okay. Doesn't matter if it's a rider or standalone?
Whether your umbrella policy is a separate standalone policy or a rider attached to another policy, like your homeowner's, generally isn't the most important factor. What is important is the breadth of coverage and the exclusions.
Got it. Any other tips?
You also want to make sure the insurance company is financially stable, ideally with an A+ or A++ rating from AM Best. Consider buying a higher coverage limit than you currently think you need. Liability awards can be huge.
Right.
And, as we'll probably discuss later, it's usually best to keep your umbrella policy with the same agent, and ideally the same insurance company, as your underlying auto and homeowners policies to minimize the chances of any gaps in coverage.
Those are some really helpful tips for making sure your umbrella policy is providing the best possible protection. Now, let's talk about getting a comprehensive overview of your personal insurance needs with something called a personal risk management audit.
Right. Think of a personal risk manager as someone who takes a holistic, bird's-eye view of your entire insurance program to make sure all the pieces fit together correctly.
Instead of just buying policies piecemeal?
Exactly. Many people end up with a collection of insurance policies bought at different times, maybe from different companies or different agents, which can easily lead to gaps in coverage, or sometimes paying for overlapping protection you don't need.
So what are the goals of an audit like this?
The main goals of a personal risk management practice, and therefore of a personal insurance audit, are threefold. First, to identify any areas where you might be underinsured or have no coverage at all and plug those gaps or find ways to reduce the risk.
Okay.
Second, to make sure your coverage limits are appropriate and balanced across all your potential risks. Not too much here, not too little there. And third, to ensure that you're getting competitive premiums for the coverage you have. It's not always about finding the absolute cheapest, but making sure the price is fair for the value received.
So it's like a financial health check specifically for your insurance. What does that process usually look like? How long does it take?
It typically starts with a detailed conversation, maybe an hour and a half to 2 hours, to really understand your assets, your potential liabilities, your lifestyle, and the various risks you face.
Okay, the interview.
Followed by a thorough review of all your current insurance policies and your overall approach to managing risk. This policy review might take, say, 3 to 4 hours.
Right.
Then the risk manager will put together a detailed written report outlining their findings and specific recommendations for improvement. This might take another 3 or 4 hours.
And what might be in that report?
The report might point out things like, maybe your college-aged child occasionally drives a roommate's car, creating an exposure under the available for regular use exclusion in your auto policy, suggesting an extended non-nouned auto endorsement.
Ah, specific gaps.
Or it might include practical loss reduction tips, like creating that photographic inventory of your home's contents we mentioned earlier, or installing a sump pump with a battery backup.
Gotcha. Then what?
The final steps are presenting the report to you, maybe another hour or hour and a half, to discuss the recommendations, answer questions, and then potentially offering ongoing service to help you implement those changes if you choose to.
That sounds like a really valuable service. What's the typical cost for something like that? I imagine it's not free.
No, it's usually fee-based.
Yeah.
A comprehensive personal risk management audit might take around 8 to 10 hours of the risk manager's time, as we just tallied up. The reading suggested a cost in the neighborhood of $1,200 for a personal audit, or perhaps around $2,000 for a combined personal and small business audit.
Okay. Is there an obligation to buy insurance afterwards?
No. The audit itself is typically self-contained, with no obligation beyond it. However, the reading notes that most clients do find the insight so valuable that they choose to work with the risk manager on an ongoing basis to manage their insurance program.
And for people on a tighter budget?
For those looking for a more budget-friendly option, some risk managers might offer a more focused review of just one or two key areas of concern rather than the full comprehensive audit.
It sounds like a really worthwhile investment for anyone who wants to get a clear and complete picture of their personal risk landscape and make sure they're properly protected.
I think it can be, especially for people with more complex financial situations or higher assets.
Now let's turn our attention to a potentially big area of unexpected liability for homeowners, hiring home care aides. This seems like a growing issue.
It is an increasingly common situation as more people choose to age in place or need help caring for elderly parents. Many homeowners hire individuals directly to provide home care services.
Right, rather than through an agency.
Exactly. Often as sole proprietors or independent contractors. The big problem here is that these individual aides often don't have their own liability insurance or, crucially, workers' compensation coverage.
And that can put the homeowner in a really risky position, right?
Absolutely. The safest approach is generally to hire through an established agency that employs the aides directly.
Why is that safer?
This way, the agency takes on the responsibility for things like payroll taxes, workers' compensation insurance, liability insurance, bonding, and other employment-related risks.
Okay, the agency handles the employer responsibility.
Right. However, if you hire an aide directly as an independent contractor, you, the homeowner, are exposed to significant financial risks, especially if your state legally requires you to carry workers' compensation insurance for a household employee and you fail to do so.
Even if you call them an independent contractor, the state might disagree.
The state might absolutely disagree based on the nature of the work and control. And the consequences can be severe.
Can you give us some specific examples of what could go wrong? The reading had a couple of stark scenarios.
Yeah, they were pretty eye-opening. Consider scenario one. Your home care aide slips and falls in your home due to something you were negligent in maintaining, say, a loose rug, and they suffer a serious injury and decide to sue you for negligence.
Okay.
Now, if your state legally requires you to have workers' compensation coverage for that household employee,
yeah,
and you don't have it,
which many people might not realize they need.
Exactly. Then your homeowners and umbrella liability policies would likely have an exclusion that says they won't cover injuries to an employee if workers' comp was required but not obtained.
So no liability coverage.
Correct. That could potentially leave you to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars out of your own pocket for their medical bills, lost wages, pain and suffering, plus your own legal defense costs. The example used was $900,000 out of pocket.
Wow. Okay, what was scenario two?
Scenario two. The aide is injured, but it's solely their own fault. No negligence on your part at all.
Okay, so you wouldn't normally be liable in tort?
Correct. However, if you were legally required to have workers' compensation but didn't, you as the homeowner can become liable under workers' comp law for what workers' compensation would have paid anyway, medical bills, lost wages, according to the state schedule.
Even though it wasn't your fault.
Yes, because workers' comp is a no-fault system. Plus, you could face legal costs and state fines for failing to carry the required insurance. The example totaled $575,000, again, with likely no reimbursement from your homeowners or umbrella policies because of that workers' comp exclusion.
That's brutal.
It really underscores the fundamental rule of risk management mentioned in the reading. Don't risk more than you can afford to lose.
Seriously. And there's an IRS risk too, right?
Yes. On top of all that, you could also face IRS penalties and back taxes if the IRS determines that the aide should have been classified as an employee rather than an independent contractor for tax purposes. Misclassification is a big issue.
Those are some really eye-opening scenarios and a stark reminder to really understand your obligations when hiring any kind of help in your home.
Absolutely critical. Check your state's workers' comp laws for domestic employees.
Let's move on to another common source of homeowner problems. Groundwater damage. Basements flooding.
Yes, damage caused by groundwater is a very frequent issue, especially with heavy rains, snowmelt, you name it. And it's important to know that standard homeowners' policies almost universally exclude water damage that comes from water entering your home at or below ground level.
So that includes
things like sewer backups, water seeping through your foundation walls or floor, and damage from surface water flooding.
So that water that ends up in your basement after a big storm probably isn't covered by my regular homeowner's insurance.
Generally, no. Not without a specific endorsement or a separate flood policy. That's why it's so important to try and mitigate the risk in the first place.
Like installing a sump pump.
Exactly. If you don't have a sump pump in your basement, having one installed is a relatively affordable way to help prevent basement flooding from groundwater.
Okay, but pumps can fail. What then?
Right. So the next step is to estimate the potential financial damage you could face if your sump pump did fail, maybe due to a power outage during the storm, which is common, or from a sewer line backing up into your house.
And then get insurance for that.
Yes. Consider purchasing an optional endorsement to your homeowner's policy called something like sump pump failure and sewer backup coverage or water backup coverage. Buy as much coverage as you think you might need, up to the maximum limit your insurance company offers.
What if they don't offer enough?
If your current insurer doesn't provide high enough limits, say, you estimate $25,000 in potential damage, but they only offer $10,000. It might be worth shopping around for an insurer who offers higher limits for this specific coverage.
Some pumps are great, but as you said, they can fail. What are some common reasons why that might happen?
Well, power loss during a storm is a big one. They can also just get overwhelmed if the volume of water coming in is too great for the pump's capacity. Or the discharge system, the pipe leading the water away from your house, could be blocked or inadequate.
What about battery backups? Do they always work?
Battery backups are a great idea to protect against power outages, but they can also fail. The battery might not hold a charge if it's old, or sometimes the water level can actually get high enough to damage the battery itself if it's not installed properly.
So backups aren't foolproof either. What if a sump pump just isn't enough or isn't feasible?
If a sump pump isn't sufficient for your property, or if it's not even a feasible option due to your home's construction or location, you might want to seriously look into federal flood insurance, the NFIP policy we talked about earlier.
Even if you're not in a high-risk flood zone?
Yes. The premiums can be surprisingly reasonable in lower risk areas, and the definition of flood under the NFIP isn't limited to major riverine disasters. It can potentially even include damage from localized heavy rain events if the water meets the policy's definition of inundating normally dry land.
It sounds like a layered approach risk reduction, like a good sump pump system, plus specialized insurance like the backup endorsement or flood insurance is the best way to protect against groundwater damage.
That's generally the best strategy, yes. Combine prevention with the right insurance.
Now, let's switch gears again and compare the insurance aspects of using car sharing services like Zipcar versus traditional car rentals. How do the risks and coverage differ?
Well, both car rentals and car sharing involve similar fundamental risks. You've got potential damage to the vehicle itself, liability for injuring other people or damaging their property, potential injury to yourself or your passengers, and the risk posed by uninsured or underinsured motorists hitting you.
Okay, same basic risk. What's the main insurance difference?
The way insurance handles these risks differs significantly. With traditional car rentals, the renter is generally responsible for all four of these risks, although rental companies are typically required by state law to carry minimum levels of liability insurance on their vehicles.
Right. State minimums are often quite low.
They often are. Now, one of the major advantages of most car sharing services, like Zipcar, is that the car sharing company usually provides insurance coverage for their vehicles, often including liability limits that are higher than state minimums, plus physical damage coverage for the car itself.
That sounds convenient, just rely on their insurance, but are there any potential downsides or gaps?
There can be. You need to consider whether the liability limits provided by the car sharing company are high enough to adequately protect you in the event of a really serious accident. Are their limits, say, $100K, $300K enough for your potential exposure?
Good question.
Also, their coverage might be voided if an unauthorized person is driving the vehicle. Zipcar, for example, has specific rules about who is allowed to drive their cars, usually only the registered member who booked it.
Ah, so no letting your friend drive.
Generally not, unless they are also an authorized Zipcar member on the account. So even if the car sharing group provides insurance, it might be a good idea to have some backup coverage of your own, just in case.
So, if you have your own personal auto insurance policy, does that offer any protection when you're using a car sharing service like Zipcar? Does it extend like it does for rentals?
If you own or lease at least one vehicle and have a personal auto policy, PAP, that policy should generally provide what's called drive other cars liability coverage on an excess basis when you're using a car sharing service like Zipcar.
Excess basis. Meaning after Zipcar's insurance.
Exactly. Zipcar's insurance would be primary, and your PP would kick in if their limits are exhausted. The common exclusion in personal auto policies for vehicles furnished or available for regular use typically doesn't apply to these short-term rentals or car-sharing uses.
Okay, what about damage to the Zipcar itself?
Right. Even though Zipcar has its own insurance coverage for damage to their cars, usually with a deductible you'd have to pay, they could potentially deny that coverage if the car is being used by an unauthorized driver, as we mentioned, or maybe if you violate some other term of the agreement.
So how do you protect yourself against that deductible or a denied claim?
If you have collision and comprehensive coverage on at least one of your own vehicles under your PAP, that coverage should typically extend to the Zipcar as well, again, likely on an excess basis over Zipcar's coverage, and subject to your own policy's deductible.
Okay. What if you don't have collision comp on your own car? Maybe because it's older.
That's trickier. If you don't have collision and comprehensive on your personal auto policy, the reading suggested looking into an umbrella liability policy that doesn't have an exclusion for damage to property in your care, custody, or control, specifically for non-noun vehicles.
Would an umbrella really cover physical damage to the Zipcar?
Some might. If the umbrella doesn't have that exclusion, it could potentially provide coverage for damage to the shared car, although it would likely be subject to a self-insured retention, SIR, which acts like a deductible, often $1,000 or more. However, this area can be complex, and state-specific insurance regulations, like one mentioned in Minnesota, can vary. It's best to check with your agent.
So even with the convenience of car sharing, it still pays to understand your own insurance coverage and potential gaps. Good advice. Now, let's circle back to something you mentioned earlier, why it's often beneficial to have consistency between your umbrella and your underlying insurance policies, keeping things together.
Right. There's a really significant advantage to having all of your liability insurance coverage, your umbrella policy, and all of your underlying policies, like your auto and homeowners, with the same insurance company, if possible.
Why is that so important?
It greatly reduces the risk of having inadequate underlying liability limits. For example, umbrella policies require you to maintain certain minimum limits on your home and auto policies like $300K or $500K. If your umbrella insurer increases those requirements and they also insure your underlying policies, they can often automatically adjust those underlying limits and simply notify you.
Ah, so they coordinate it automatically.
Exactly. It prevents a gap from forming without you realizing it. This puts you in a much stronger position if you ever face a lawsuit that goes into the umbrella layer. It also helps to minimize the potential for errors and omissions or E&O claims against your insurance agent because there's less chance of miscoordination.
What if you prefer to work with one agent but have your underlying policies with different insurance companies than your umbrella policy? Maybe the pricing is better that way.
That's a common scenario. If using the same insurance company for everything isn't possible or practical, it's absolutely crucial that all of your policies are handled by the same insurance agent.
One agent for everything.
Yes. That way, the agent is fully aware of the underlying liability limit requirements of your umbrella policy and can make sure your other policies from different companies have the necessary limits in place. They can also make sure that any new risks or changes in your situation, like buying a boat or that vacant land we discussed, are properly addressed across all of your policies, including making sure the umbrella picks it up if needed.
And what's the least ideal situation? The one to avoid?
The scenario that can create the most problems, what the reading called toxic, is when you have different insurance agents handling your underlying policies, home, auto, and your umbrella policy.
Why is that so bad?
In that situation, it becomes solely your responsibility as the insured to communicate any changes or increases in the underlying limit requirements from your umbrella insurer to all of your other agents handling the primary policies. The chance of something falling through the cracks, of you forgetting or the agent not acting, is just too high. This significantly increases the risk of having dangerous gaps in your overall coverage when you need it most.
So keeping things consistent with either the same insurer or at least the same agent is definitely the best approach for coordinating that crucial umbrella coverage.
Absolutely the safest way to go.
Now let's shift our focus to life insurance and why it's so important to reevaluate your needs as your life changes. People often buy it and forget it.
That's very true. Life insurance needs change dramatically throughout your life. Getting married, having kids, buying a house, kids growing up, and it's very common to find imbalances in people's life insurance programs.
What kind of imbalances?
Well, you might have a small whole life policy your parents bought for you when you were young, maybe with only $10,000 or $25,000 in coverage. That's now woefully inadequate for your current family's financial needs if something happened to you. The example used was needing $1 million but having very limited means.
Right. Or maybe relying too much on work insurance.
Exactly. You might be relying solely on the group life insurance provided by your employer, which typically doesn't go with you if you leave that job. It's usually not portable.
And the optional coverage.
The optional group life insurance offered by employers, where you pay extra for more coverage, can also be quite expensive compared to what you could often find on the private market, especially if you're young and healthy. And again, it's often not portable either.
So what does a more well-rounded or balanced insurance program look like for, say, a young family? The reading gave an example.
Right. It outlined a program for a hypothetical young family of four with a combined income of around $90,000 and a net worth of $250,000.
What did that include?
It suggested around $1 million in total life insurance coverage, primarily in the form of affordable 20 or 30-year level term policies for both parents.
Okay. Term life for the big need.
Yes. It should also include long-term disability insurance for both income earners, potentially with supplemental individual policies if their group disability coverage at work pays benefits on a pre-tax basis, making the benefits taxable.
Good point about disability, often overlooked.
Crucial. They'd also need good major medical insurance with high lifetime benefit caps. At least $5 million was suggested. Plus, adequate liability limits on their auto and homeowners policies, feeding into that umbrella. If they employ any domestic staff, like a nanny, they'd need to consider workers' compensation and employers' liability insurance, ensuring the limits satisfy their umbrella policy's requirements. The umbrella should also provide excess coverage over that employer's liability.
Okay.
And finally, basic but critical stuff. Having properly designated beneficiaries and contingent beneficiaries on all life insurance policies. And for the long-term disability coverage, ideally having features like future purchase options to increase coverage later without medical exams, coverage for both partial and total disability extending to retirement age, and a cost of living adjustment, COLA rider, to help the benefit keep pace with inflation.
That sounds like a really comprehensive plan, covering life, disability, health, liability. But what's often the missing piece, even in seemingly well-structured insurance programs like that?
What's often missing, according to the reading, is the guidance of a personal risk manager, that person we talked about earlier, who has a broad understanding of all types of personal insurance, life, health, disability, P&C, benefits, and can ensure that the entire program is balanced.
Making sure everything works together.
Exactly. Ensuring coverage limits are appropriate across the board, that there aren't any significant gaps between policies, and also making sure the premiums are reasonable for the value received. This level of holistic expertise is something that few traditional insurance agents, who might specialize only in P&C or only in life health, typically possess.
How does a personal risk manager add value beyond what a typical insurance agent provides, especially if they charge fees?
Well, personal risk managers, because they often work on a fee basis, can provide objective advice. They can even recommend buying less insurance in certain areas if that's truly in the client's best interest, with full transparency about their fees.
So not just commission-driven?
Potentially, yes. They take a comprehensive view of your entire risk profile, not just the policies they might directly sell to you. They can advise you on your employee benefits choices at work, help you understand the insurance implications of contracts you sign, like car or boat rental agreements, moving and storage contracts, even venue contracts for a wedding reception. They essentially act as your advocate across all aspects of your personal risk management.
So their fee is for that expertise and oversight.
Exactly. The fee structure is often positioned as being similar to paying an insurance premium. You're paying for their ongoing expertise and advice on an as-needed basis to manage your overall risk exposure effectively.
It sounds like having a personal risk manager can provide a much more strategic, coordinated approach to protecting your overall financial well-being, especially for complex situations.
It certainly offers a different model. The reading acknowledged the challenges of being a personal risk manager, staying updated on everything, client communication, fee collection, but also emphasized the satisfaction of making a significant difference and potentially enjoying the work more than just selling policies.
Makes sense. Now let's address a specific property risk that many people might not think about until it happens. Managing the risks associated with vacant homes.
Right. Vacant homes, whether they just have minimal furniture left or are completely empty and unoccupied, present a significant insurance challenge, particularly if they're vacant for an extended period. The typical threshold in homeowners' policies is 60 days or more.
60 days. And what happens after that?
Most standard homeowners' insurance policies automatically reduce important coverages once a home has been vacant for that length of time. The policy contract itself changes the coverage.
What kind of coverage limitations are we talking about? What gets reduced or excluded?
One major restriction is that vandalism and malicious mischief coverage is often completely excluded on a vacant home after 60 days.
No coverage for vandalism at all?
Often, none. In fact, some of the newer homeowners policy forms even go further and exclude any subsequent losses that result from an act of vandalism, such as a fire started by vandals.
Well, that's harsh. What else?
Glass breakage might also be excluded. And beyond specific coverage reductions, many standard insurance companies simply won't continue to insure a home that's been vacant for that long and might cancel the policy midterm or choose not to renew it at the end of the policy period.
So finding insurance can be tough, too.
Yes. If you do need insurance for a vacant property, your options are often limited. You might find coverage in the non-standard or surplus lines market, but it often involves a trade-off. Either very basic named peril coverage at a relatively reasonable price, or more comprehensive coverage, if you can find it, at a cost that can be 4 to 5 times higher than a standard homeowner's policy.
So the best approach is probably to avoid triggering those vacancy restrictions, if at all possible. How can you do that through risk management strategies other than just relying on insurance?
Exactly. Strategies like having someone check on the property regularly, maybe leaving some lights on timers, making sure the landscaping is maintained, keeping mail picked up, basically ensuring the property doesn't appear, obviously vacant, can sometimes help you argue against the vacancy clause being applied, although the policy language is usually pretty clear.
Okay, but if avoidance isn't possible and insurance is necessary.
If you do need insurance for a vacant home, it's really important to compare the actual policy forms from insurance companies that specialize in this type of coverage, like those in the non-traditional market. The terms and conditions can vary quite significantly, so just comparing price isn't enough.
You mentioned comparing policies from Foremost and Mount Vernon for vacant dwellings in the reading. What were the key differences highlighted there?
Right, that was a good comparison. Foremost was described as typically offering coverage on a vacant dwelling based on actual cash value, ACV, meaning they'll deduct depreciation when paying a claim. They don't usually offer replacement cost coverage.
Okay, ACV only. What about covered perils?
The list of covered perils under a Foremost vacant home policy was also often limited, maybe just a fire and extended coverage perils, like wind, hail, explosion, but maybe not things like weight of ice and snow or water damage from birth pipes.
How did Mount Vernon compare?
Mount Vernon, on the other hand, was presented as often offering full replacement cost coverage for vacant homes, as long as the property is insured for at least 80% of its replacement value. And they may also offer broader, special perils coverage, often called all risk, covering anything not specifically excluded, with no vacancy restrictions at all. that provides much more comprehensive protection.
And the claim payout could be very different.
Absolutely. The example given involved storm damage. Under the Foremost ACV policy, the payout might be $120,000 after depreciation, whereas under the Mount Vernon replacement cost policy, the payout could be the full $200,000 cost to repair. A significant difference.
That's a really crucial distinction to be aware of. If you own a property that's currently vacant or might become vacant, read the policy form.
Definitely. Don't assume all vacant home policies are the same.
Now let's take a step back and look at the historical development of liability coverage and how the umbrella policy came into being. It wasn't always around.
No, not at all. The concept of liability insurance in the United States started out with a very narrow focus. Early forms of insurance primarily addressed specific risks, like employer's liability, injuries to workers, public liability, injuries to the public on premises, and auto liability. Very siloed.
So how did broader coverage develop?
A key figure mentioned was Cuthbert Heath. He brought non-marine insurance underwriting expertise to Lloyd's of London back in 1887. This gave U.S. organizations access to more tailored liability coverage options than what domestic insurers were generally offering at the time.
Oh.
For the next 30 years or so, the term employer's liability was often used quite broadly, sometimes encompassing many different types of liability policies. Occasionally, it was just called accident insurance.
But specific types started to emerge.
Yes. By around 1915, we started to see the growth of other distinct forms of liability insurance, such as product liability for faulty products, professional liability for errors by professionals, and auto liability becoming more standardized.
And as the limits of these primary liability policies started to increase, especially for businesses, that led to the development of the excess liability market, right? Need for higher limits.
Exactly. As primary liability limits grew, there was a corresponding need for reinsurance to help spread the risk and adequately capitalize these higher insured exposures. Cuthbert Heath was a real visionary here, too. He co-founded the Excess Liability Insurance Company Limited in 1894.
And he was involved after the San Francisco earthquake?
Yes, he also pioneered the concept of excess of loss reinsurance after the devastating 1906 San Francisco earthquake, specifically for the Hartford Insurance Company. This introduced the idea of layering stacking policies on top of each other to achieve very high liability limits, which is a fundamental practice still used extensively today in commercial insurance.
But those early liability policies, even the excess ones, still they had their limitations. They didn't cover everything. What eventually led to the creation of the true umbrella liability policy as we think of it now.
Right. The early liability policies often had gaps in their coverage between the different policy types. There was a growing need for a single policy that could do three key things. First, provide a broad layer of excess liability protection over various underlying primary policies, offering high limits for catastrophic liability situations.
Okay, higher limits.
Second, cover some risks that might be self-insured or completely uninsured by the primary policies, filling gaps. And third, importantly, to drop down and provide coverage from the first dollar, subject to a self-insured retention or deductible, if the underlying primary policy's aggregate limits were completely used up by earlier claims during the policy year.
The drop-down feature. That sounds key.
It was. Walter Smith and George Barnes at the brokerage firm Marsh & McLennan played a crucial role in addressing this drop-down need in the late 1940s. They worked with Lloyd's underwriters to add this feature to their excess liability policies.
And this was the birth of the umbrella.
Pretty much. Initially, this broad form of umbrella coverage was exclusively available through Marsh's affiliates in Montreal, interestingly. And even then, the reading notes that the adoption rate by Marsh's clients was relatively slow in the early years, only reaching about 100 policies by 1956.
But eventually, umbrella policies became more widely used and further developed, didn't they? They're common now.
Oh, yes. By the 1970s, casualty insurance programs for businesses often included a lead umbrella liability policy with one or more layers of excess umbrella coverage sitting above it to achieve the increasingly higher liability limits that were becoming necessary due to rising litigation awards. It wasn't uncommon to see total liability limits of $20 million or more.
But then Lloyd's changed things a bit.
Interestingly, yes. Around this same time, Lloyd's underwriters began to somewhat contract the scope of their umbrella coverage with the introduction of what were called the LRD forms. These new forms included more specific exclusions, for example, the care, custody, or control exclusion we discussed earlier regarding property damage, and aimed to align more closely with the terms and conditions of the underlying primary policies. The goal was more concurrent coverage, reducing those gap-filling aspects.
So less drop-down, more follow-form excess?
Generally moving in that direction, yes. While Lloyd's continued to be a major player in the umbrella market, they increasingly focused on providing coverage in the higher excess layers, maybe starting above $3 million, then $5 million, eventually even $10 million in underlying limits, partly to avoid getting dragged into the more frequent U.S. litigation occurring in the lower layers.
And U.S. insurers stepped up.
Yes. U.S. insurance companies significantly increased their capacity to write umbrella liability coverage during the 1970s, offering limits up to $25 million or more, though heavily reinsured. By the end of the decade, there were hundreds of different sources available for umbrella protection.
It's fascinating to see how the concept of liability coverage has evolved over time, from specific perils to these broad, high-limit umbrella policies, and even how they've contracted and expanded in scope.
It really shows how the insurance market adapts, or tries to adapt, to changing risks and legal environments.
Now let's move on to a really important aspect of commercial insurance, especially for businesses that suffer property damage, business interruption insurance. How do you even figure out how much you need?
That's the first challenge. Business interruption, or BI, insurance is designed to help a business recover the income it loses and cover the ongoing expenses it incurs due to a covered physical loss that damages its property and shuts down or slows operations.
Okay. How is the exposure measured?
Larger corporations often provide their insurers with business interruption values on an annual basis. These are calculations, usually done using a standard worksheet, to help the insurers understand the potential financial impact of a significant loss.
But is that worksheet enough?
Well, the reading points out that the standard BI worksheet is often quite basic and doesn't always fully capture the true extent of a company's business interruption exposure. A real assessment needs to consider a wide range of factors beyond just historical profit and expenses, things like dependencies on key suppliers or customers, seasonal fluctuations, market trends, potential bottlenecks, etc.
So when a business interruption claim actually occurs, what's the process for proving the amount of the loss? It sounds complicated.
It can be. In business interruption claims, the burden of proof, the responsibility for proving the financial loss, rests squarely with the insured business.
Okay, the business has to prove it.
Yes. They need to provide objective, verifiable evidence to support their claim. The calculations generally revolve around determining what the business's financial performance would have been had the loss not occurred.
Projecting the future that didn't happen.
Exactly. Which often involves making projections based on past financial results, budgets, forecasts, and anticipated future conditions, like planned marketing campaigns or new product launches.
So documentation is key again.
Absolutely. Clearly explaining the sequence of loss events, the methodologies used to calculate the loss, and all the underlying assumptions is crucial. Adjusters appreciate clear, well-supported claims, and it generally leads to a smoother and more timely claim settlement process.
That makes sense. Solid documentation helps everyone. Now let's think about what businesses can do to limit the impact of the business interruption, looking at the coverage itself. What are some important aspects to understand? The period of restoration.
Right. The period of restoration is a critical concept. It's the time frame during which business income losses are covered. Importantly, business income coverage typically has a waiting period, often 72 hours, before coverage kicks in.
Like a time deductible.
Exactly. This waiting period effectively acts like a deductible in terms of lost income. The business absorbs the loss during that initial period.
And when does the coverage stop?
Under the standard ISO policy form, the business income coverage usually ends the earlier of when the damaged property should reasonably be repaired or replaced with reasonable speed, or when business actually resumes at a new permanent location.
But what if sales don't bounce back right away, even after you reopen?
That's where extended business income coverage comes in. Most policies include this, and it typically kicks in after the physical repairs are completed and lasts for a certain period, often 30 consecutive days in the standard form, to allow the business time to ramp back up and rebuild its customer base.
Can you get longer than 30 days?
Yes. Businesses can usually purchase longer extended business income periods, 60, 90, 180, even up to 365 days for an additional premium. This is often very important for businesses that rely on returning customers.
What about coverage if you can't access your building even if it's not damaged, like if the street is blocked?
That's civil authority coverage. This covers the loss of income a business suffers if a government authority prohibits access to the business premises due to direct physical damage by a covered cause of loss to property other than the insured's own, such as that fire at an adjacent building blocking the road. There's usually a waiting period here, too, and the coverage period is often limited, maybe to 2, 3, or 4 weeks, so you need to check your policy.
Okay. And utility interruptions, power outages.
Utility interruption coverage is another key consideration. If a business loses income because of an interruption in incoming utilities like electricity, water, or communications, even if their own property isn't directly damaged, this type of coverage can respond. Various forms of utility interruption coverage are available, often by endorsement, so it's important to review your specific exposures, which utilities are critical, and the waiting periods associated with each.
Catastrophic events like major hurricanes and earthquakes really highlight the critical importance of business interruption planning and understanding these coverages, don't they? Supply chains get disrupted.
Absolutely. Events like Hurricane Katrina and the 2011 earthquake and tsunami in Japan served as major wake-up calls regarding the potential for significant supply chain disruptions impacting businesses far from the actual disaster zone. Hurricane Sandy also underscored that even businesses located far inland can be severely impacted by utility outages resulting from events that didn't directly damage their own property. The reading noted that utility interruption is often considered a direct peril, not necessarily an off-premises contingent impact, which can affect how coverage applies.
So businesses should use these events as learning opportunities.
Exactly. These types of events really emphasize the need for businesses to conduct thorough what-if scenarios for their own operations and think about all the potential ways their business could be disrupted, both directly and indirectly.
I also saw mention of service interruption insurance. How does that differ from standard business interruption coverage or the utility interruption endorsements we just talked about?
Right. Standard commercial property policies typically exclude losses that result from interruptions of off-premises services, like utilities, unless you add that specific endorsement we discussed. Now, some specialized standalone policies, perhaps equipment breakdown policies, might offer very limited direct damage coverage. The example was $25,000 for spoilage of perishable goods due to a power outage.
Right.
But they usually don't provide any coverage for the resulting loss of business income, the time element loss, associated with that utility failure, unless specifically added.
So where do you get time element coverage for service interruption?
Equipment breakdown insurance, sometimes called boiler and machinery insurance, can sometimes offer a solution. These policies often can be endorsed to include both direct damage and time element, business income and extra expense coverage, resulting from the interruption of utility services, although typically with specific sublimits.
So you need to check the details carefully.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It's really important to carefully review what utility services are covered.
Yeah, it works.
Water, communications, what perils are covered, just equipment breakdown at the utility or overhead lines too, and exactly what triggers coverage in a service interruption policy or endorsement.
And setting the limit for direct damage.
When you're determining the appropriate direct damage sublimits for service interruption, it's a good idea to estimate the probable maximum loss to your contents, like that spoilage example, in the event of a critical utility service disruption.
So again, it comes down to really understanding the specific details of the coverage and matching it to your actual exposures.
Always. Assumption is the enemy in insurance.
Now let's talk about getting insurance for new construction. If you're building something new, how do you insure it during the construction process with a builder's risk policy?
Yes, exactly. When a new building is being constructed, the primary way to insure the structure and materials during the course of construction is with a builder's risk policy.
Okay. And who needs this coverage? Who has an interest?
Well, during construction, there are usually several parties who have a financial interest in the project. This includes the property owner who commissioned the building, the general contractor overseeing the project, and potentially various subcontractors performing specific work like electrical or plumbing.
And they all have insurable interests.
Yes. This financial interest is what we call insurable interest, which is a legal requirement. It means they have a financial stake in the property and stand to suffer a financial loss if it's damaged during construction. They've expended funds, provided labor or supplies, or have anticipated profit tied up in the project.
Who typically purchases the builder's risk insurance policy, the owner or the contractor?
The property owner usually has a couple of main options. They can either purchase the builder's risk policy themselves to cover the construction phase, naming the contractor as an additional insured perhaps, or they can make it a requirement in their contract with the general contractor that the contractor obtain the policy, naming the owner as an additional insured.
Does it matter who buys it?
In theory, regardless of who actually purchases it, the scope of coverage, the terms and conditions, and the overall policy limits should be sufficient to cover the interests of all key parties involved. The contract should specify the requirements clearly.
And it covers more than just damage to the building itself.
It can, and often should. It's important to remember that direct physical damage to the building under construction isn't the only potential financial exposure. If the project is delayed due to a covered loss like a fire or windstorm, there could also be a loss of potential rental income if it's an investment property, business income.
Okay.
And there are also what are called soft costs. These include things like additional architectural and engineering fees needed after a loss, extra financing costs or interest incurred due to the delay, and additional legal expenses that might result from the damage. These soft costs usually require a specific endorsement to be covered under the builder's risk policy. They aren't automatic.
What are some key questions that property owners or contractors should ask their insurance company when setting up a builder's risk policy?
They should definitely ask if the policy includes or can be endorsed to include coverage for those time element losses, loss of rental income, business income, and those soft costs we just mentioned. They should also inquire if the policy can be specifically structured so the named insured includes not just the property owner or the general contractor, but ideally lists both the owner and the GC, and perhaps major subcontractors, clarifying that their insured status is limited to their specific financial interest in the construction project. This avoids disputes later.
What about installation floaters? I've heard of those. Are those ever a good option for subcontractors like electricians or plumbers to have on their own?
Generally speaking, it's not usually recommended for subcontractors to separately insure their specific work, like the electrical system they're installing, with their own installation floater if the owner's or general contractor's builder's risk policy can be structured properly to cover the interests of all parties, including the subcontractors, as insureds.
Why is that not recommended?
Having multiple separate policies covering different parts of the same project can sometimes lead to gaps or overlaps in coverage. It can complicate the claims process if damage occurs, whose policy pays, and potentially increase overall insurance costs due to duplicated coverage and administrative effort.
But are there times when an installation floater is needed by a contractor?
Yes, absolutely. There are legitimate situations where a contractor might need their own installation floater. For example, if there simply isn't a builder's risk policy in place covering the overall project, or if the main builder's risk policy specifically excludes the type of work they're doing or doesn't provide adequate limits or perils for their materials, especially if stored off-site. In those cases, the contractor would rely on their own installation floater policy to cover their materials and labor until their work is formally installed, completed, accepted, and paid for.
So a coordinated insurance approach under a single comprehensive builder's risk policy covering all key parties is usually the most efficient and effective way to insure a new construction project.
Generally, yes. Clear contracts and a well-structured builder's risk policy are key.
Now, let's delve into the concept of coinsurance in property insurance. You mentioned it briefly before with homeowners, but let's unpack it more, especially for commercial property. It sounds a bit like a penalty if you don't have enough coverage.
That's a good way to think about its effect, yes. Coinsurance is a very common feature in property insurance policies, both commercial and even residential, as we noted. Its main purpose, from the insurer's perspective, is to encourage policyholders to carry insurance coverage limits that are adequate relative to the actual value of the property being insured. It helps ensure fair premiums for everyone.
And the clause itself can vary.
Yes. Coinsurance clauses can differ from one insurance company to another, especially with policies that use non-standard or independent filings rather than standard ISO forms. So it's really important to read your specific policy carefully to understand exactly how the coinsurance clause works and what percentage applies.
How does coinsurance typically work in commercial property insurance for direct physical damage to a building or contents?
Okay, in commercial property insurance, the policyholder first chooses a direct damage coverage limit based on either the replacement cost value, RCV, or the actual cash value, ACV, of the property.
Right, the limit you buy.
Then the coinsurance percentage, which is stated in the policy, Tommy, percentages are 80%, 90%, or 100% determines two things. First, it also influences the rate credit you receive on your premium. A higher coinsurance percentage, like 100%, usually means you agree to insure closer to full value, so you get a larger premium discount or credit.
Okay, higher percentage, lower rate, but what's the catch?
The catch is, if you don't insure your property for at least that stated coinsurance percentage of its total value at the time of the loss, you could face a financial penalty if you have a partial loss. You become a coinsurer for the part you underinsured.
Can you give an example? The reading had some numbers.
Sure. Let's say a building's replacement cost value is actually $2.4 million at the time of a fire. Your policy has a 90% coinsurance clause, meaning you are required to insure it for at least 90% of $2.04, which is $2,160,000.
Okay, required $2.16 in coverage.
But maybe you only insured it for $2 million. Now, you have a $500,000 fire loss. Because you carry less insurance than required, the coinsurance formula kicks in.
How does that formula work?
It's basically amount of insurance carried, amount of insurance required, X amount of loss, amount paid, before deductible, up to the policy limit.
So in this case?
It would be $2 million, $2,116,000 x $500,000. That comes out to about $462,963. So even though your loss was $500,000 and your policy limit was $2, you'd only get $462,963 paid, minus your deductible. You'd be short over $37,000 just due to the coinsurance penalty.
Ouch. And if you were insured for even less, say $1 million.
Then the penalty would be much worse. $1 million and $2,160,000, as $500,000 is only about $231,481 recovered before the deductible, a huge shortfall.
So getting the value right and meeting that coinsurance percentage is critical. Is there a way to avoid the penalty? You mentioned agreed value.
Yes. The agreed value option is available in many commercial property policies. If you and the insurance company agree in advance on the total value of the property, which usually requires submitting a signed statement of values, the coinsurance requirement is typically suspended or waived for that policy period, usually 1 year. This eliminates the risk of a coinsurance penalty, but you might pay a slightly higher rate since the insurer loses the protection of the coinsurance clause.
So it's really important to get an accurate valuation of your commercial property and keep it updated. What about coinsurance in business income coverage? Does that work similarly?
Yes. As we touched on, business income coverage often also has a coinsurance requirement. However, instead of being based on the physical value of the property, it's typically based on the business's projected net profit, plus its normal operating expenses that would have been earned or incurred over a 12-month period following the loss.
So insuring the income stream adequately.
Exactly. It's another way for the insurance company to ensure that the business is insuring its potential income exposure at an appropriate level relative to its actual potential loss.
And extra expense coverage doesn't have coinsurance.
Correct. Extra expense coverage, which pays for the necessary extra costs a business incurs to avoid or minimize the suspension of operations after a covered loss, like renting temporary space or equipment, typically is not subject to coinsurance. Instead, as mentioned before, the limits for extra expense coverage are often structured as percentages that apply to different periods of restoration. Go example, 40% recovery in month one, 80% by month two, 100% thereafter, up to the policy limit.
Are there other ways insurers help manage coinsurance? Inflation guard.
Yes. Some insurers may offer endorsements that automatically increase your coverage limits over the policy period to help keep pace with inflation, an inflation guard. Or, in some cases, they might agree to temporarily suspend the coinsurance clause for the policy period if certain conditions are met. Ultimately, it's the insurance agent's responsibility to educate their commercial clients about how coinsurance works, the importance of accurate valuations, and the options available to manage it, helping them avoid unexpected penalties and also preventing potential errors and omissions claims against the agent if a penalty occurs.
And you mentioned homeowners and NFIP policies also have coinsurance.
That's correct. It was a bit of a surprise highlight in the reading. Many standard homeowners insurance policies, particularly ISO forms like the HO2 and HO3, include an 80% coinsurance requirement if you want to be paid the full replacement cost for a covered loss to your dwelling. If you're insured for less than 80% of the replacement cost, the payout might be prorated or switched to actual cash value. Similarly, the National Flood Insurance Program's dwelling form also has its own coinsurance provisions that policyholders need to be aware of to ensure they receive the maximum eligible payment.
The bottom line is that for anyone involved in risk management, whether professionally or for their own personal insurance, it's crucial to read and understand the coinsurance clauses in all types of property insurance policies.
Absolutely. It's a fundamental part of how property insurance works and can have a major impact on claim payments.
It definitely sounds like a part of the policy that can easily be overlooked, but could have significant financial consequences. Now, let's discuss the definition of direct physical loss and how that often plays a role in claims involving mold damage. That term seems key.
It is. Most property insurance policies require that there be a direct physical loss or damage to covered property for coverage to apply. It's the trigger.
Okay. And how does mold fit in?
Well, many commercial property policies do include some coverage for loss or damage caused by mold, fungus, or bacteria, and often include cost for remediation. However, this coverage usually comes with a specific, often low sublimit, like $15,000 or $25,000. And crucially, this mold coverage is almost always contingent on the mold resulting from a covered direct physical loss from some other covered peril, like water damage from a burst pipe that wasn't discovered right away.
So the mold itself isn't the initial trigger, usually?
Generally, not under standard forms. It has to stem from something else that is covered. However, the courts have often interpreted the meaning of direct physical loss and the related concept of tangible damage in different ways. And these interpretations can have a significant impact on whether or not a mold claim or even other types of claims are covered.
Can you give us an example of how these differing interpretations can affect a mold claim? You mentioned the Universal Image Products case earlier.
Right. In that case, Universal Image Products, Inc. v. Federal Inns Company, a tenant vacated their leased office space because of a significant mold problem. But the mold was present in the building's HVAC system and inside the walls property, which belonged to the landlord, not the tenant.
Okay, the landlord owned the moldy stuff.
Yes, and the landlord subsequently remediated the mold at no cost to the tenant. However, the tenant filed an insurance claim under their own business property policy.
What were they claiming for?
They claimed losses. They said they incurred as a result of the mold situation, including the value of leasehold improvements they had made, their moving expenses, and lost business income due to the disruption and move.
And the insurer denied it.
Yes, the insurance company denied the tenant's claim, arguing that there had been no direct physical loss to the tenant's own insured property. The mold damaged the landlord's property.
And the court agreed.
Yes, the court ultimately agreed with the insurer. It adopted a rather narrow interpretation of the term direct physical loss, emphasizing that the property that was tangibly damaged by the mold belonged to the landlord, not the tenant. There also seemed to be an underlying issue noted in the reading that the tenant hadn't adequately proven that their decision to move and the resulting costs were directly and necessarily caused by a physical loss to their own insured property, rather than just a general concern about the building's environment.
So that case really highlights how crucial it is to understand how the courts in your jurisdiction interpret the phrase direct physical loss, and that the damage generally needs to be to your insured property for your policy to respond.
Exactly. It underscores that the damage needs to be tangible and affect the property covered by your specific policy, not just create an undesirable environment. Understanding this interpretation is critical for managing expectations around mold claims and other potentially ambiguous loss scenarios.
It really underscores that the damage needs to be to your own insured property. Now, let's broaden our scope and talk about the overall importance of really understanding all the details in your insurance coverage beyond just specific terms like direct physical loss.
Right. The reading emphasized that insurance coverage disputes often arise not just because the policy language itself is ambiguous, but also because there's a fundamental lack of understanding of the specific coverage details. And consequently, unmet expectations on the part of the policyholder when a claim occurs.
So managing expectations is key.
Definitely. Ideally, the best insurance policy is the one that covers the loss in the way the insured person reasonably expects it to.
Mm-hmm.
But to get there, the first step in managing risk, whether you ultimately use insurance or some other method like avoidance or loss control, is always to thoroughly identify all of your potential exposures first. What could possibly go wrong?
And don't assume all insurers are the same.
Absolutely not. It's also important to remember that even insurance companies that might seem very similar on the surface, maybe in terms of financial strength ratings or even price, can actually offer significantly different levels of coverage for specific types of loss exposures due to variations in their policy forms and endorsements.
You mentioned the standard ISO building and personal property coverage form, CP00010, as a baseline. What were some examples of coverage details within that form that are important to understand, like the definition of stock?
Yes, understanding the definitions is crucial. The definition of stock in that ISO form is key to understanding both direct damage coverage for inventory and also potentially business interruption coverage. It's broad. It includes not just finished goods ready for sale, but also raw materials, goods currently in the process of being manufactured, materials used for packing and shipping, and even materials that are being held for recycling or reconditioning. Knowing what falls under stock helps determine the right coverage limit.
What about pollution coverage under that standard form?
That's another critical area with limitations. When it comes to pollution-related losses, coverage under the standard ISO property form is generally excluded unless the release, dispersal, or escape of pollutants results directly from one of the specified causes of loss listed in the policy.
And what are those specified causes of loss?
It's basically a list of named perils, like fire, lightning, explosion, windstorm, hail, smoke, aircraft, vehicles, riot, vandalism, sprinkler leakage, sinkhole collapse, volcanic action. It notably does not include things like accidental spills during routine operations, gradual seepage, or intentional illegal dumping by others. So many common pollution scenarios aren't covered perils.
Okay, and what about costs related to building laws and pollution?
That's another potential gap. Standard ISO property policies don't automatically provide coverage for the increased costs you might incur if building codes or other laws require you to demolish and rebuild undamaged parts of your property due to pollutant contamination. Even if the initial cause of loss, like a fire that released the pollutants, was a covered peril, you usually need a specific ordinance or law endorsement with adequate limits for that.
The reading used the ABC manufacturing example again here. Fire in plant 2 leads to an EPA contamination order. How did that illustrate these points?
Right. In that scenario, while the direct physical damage from the fire itself to ABC Manufacturing's insured property would likely be covered under their standard ISO policy, the additional costs they incurred to comply with the EPA's order to demolish and rebuild parts of the plant due to the resulting contamination probably wouldn't be covered under the standard policy's basic ordinance and law coverage provisions unless they had purchased higher specific limits for that exposure, often called coverage C under ordinance or law.
And business interruption from the pollution aspect.
Similarly, while business interruption coverage might be triggered by the direct physical damage caused by the fire, the standard ISO forms generally don't cover business interruption losses that result solely from the pollution contamination itself, without that initial direct physical damage from a covered cause of loss like the fire. If the EPA shut them down just due to contamination discovered later, without a fire, the standard BI coverage likely wouldn't respond.
So the recommendation is a separate pollution policy?
Yes. For more comprehensive coverage for both first-party cleanup costs and third-party liabilities related to pollution, businesses typically need to purchase a separate, specialized pollution liability insurance policy.
The overarching point seems to be thinking about risks broadly, not just based on policy names.
Exactly. The reading concluded that exposures should be thought of in terms of cause and effect, what could happen, and what would the consequences be. Not just assuming coverage based on the title of your insurance policy, proactively reviewing, understanding, and even testing your insurance coverage against various potential loss scenarios is a crucial part of effective risk management.
That really drives home the point that you need to go beyond just the basic overview of your insurance policies and dig into the details. Now, let's talk about what happens when there's a disagreement about the amount of an insurance claim, not whether it's covered, but how much it's worth. How does the appraisal process work?
Right. Appraisal is a specific dispute resolution process that's outlined in the condition section of most property insurance policies. It's designed only to resolve disagreements about the dollar amount of the loss.
Just the amount, not coverage itself.
Correct. It's important to understand that appraisal is not used to settle disagreements about whether the loss is actually covered under the policy in the first place, or disputes about the cause of the loss. Those are coverage issues, typically decided by the insurer initially, and potentially by courts later if disputed. Appraisal is strictly for quantifying the value of the covered damage.
So how does the appraisal process typically work? Who's involved?
The appraisal process usually involves a panel of three individuals. Each party, the insured, you, and the insurance company, appoints their own appraiser. These two party-appointed appraisers must be competent and disinterested. They then work together to try and agree on the amount of the loss for each item in dispute.
What if the two appraisers can't agree?
If they can't reach an agreement on all items, they will jointly select a neutral third party called an umpire. The umpire must also be competent and disinterested. The decision agreed upon by any two of the three, one appraiser and the umpire, or both appraisers, sets the amount of loss, and that amount is binding on both the insured and the insurer.
What are some key things to consider when you're selecting your appraiser? It sounds like a critical choice.
it is absolutely crucial to choose your appraiser carefully. The reading highlighted three key areas of knowledge. First, knowledge of the subject matter. If you have a dispute about complex roof damage, you want an appraiser experienced in roofing, not necessarily a general contractor or a public adjuster who doesn't specialize. If it's a business income dispute, you need a forensic accountant.
Makes sense. What else?
Second, knowledge of the process. Your appraiser should have a good understanding of how appraisal works procedurally, including how to effectively present your position and supporting evidence to the other appraiser and potentially to the umpire. They need negotiation skills.
Right. And the third area?
Third, knowledge of the parties involved. While appraisers must be disinterested, having an appraiser who is familiar with the insurance company's representatives or the appraiser they typically use can sometimes help streamline the process and narrow down the issues in dispute more efficiently through established professional relationships.
And how is the umpire selected? That seems like another really important decision, maybe even more so if the appraisers are far apart.
The selection of the umpire is often the most critical step, as the umpire's decision, when siding with one appraiser, will ultimately be binding.
Who usually picks the umpire?
Ideally, the two-party appointed appraisers agree on a qualified and neutral umpire themselves. If they cannot agree, the policy usually states that either party can petition a local court judge to appoint the umpire.
Is getting a judge involved ideal?
Not always. The reading noted that judges don't always have specific expertise in property insurance, construction, or the specific type of loss involved, so their selection might not always be the most technically qualified person. Therefore, it's often a good idea for both parties, through their appraisers, to try hard to agree on an umpire themselves, or at least agree on a protocol for selecting the umpire at the outset, perhaps including an agreement that neither appraisers will contact potential umpires unilaterally before selection.
Good tip. What about the scope of the appraisal?
It's also really important to have a clear written agreement between the parties defining the specific scope of what the appraisal panel will be deciding. Is it just the replacement cost value, actual cash value, the period of restoration for BI? Defining the questions clearly up front avoids confusion later.
And what if there are still open coverage questions lingering while appraisal is happening?
That's a tricky situation. You need to decide how to handle it. One option is to pause the appraisal and seek a court ruling, a declaratory judgment, on the coverage issues first. The other option is to proceed with appraisal, but get an agreement with the insurance company to have the appraisal panel issue an award that includes separate findings for each potential coverage theory. For example, they might determine the amount of loss assuming replacement cost applies and the amount assuming actual cash value applies, letting the coverage decision determine which value is ultimately used.
Okay. And finally, the proof of loss form. How does that relate to getting paid after appraisal?
The proof of loss is a formal statement from the insured detailing the claim. Typically, an insurance company is obligated to pay a covered loss within a certain time frame, stated in the policy, often 30 or 60 days after they receive your properly completed and sworn proof of loss, provided all the policy terms and conditions have been met, and either an agreement has been reached on the amount of the loss or a final binding appraisal award has been made. The appraisal award essentially finalizes the amount of loss piece.
So a knowledgeable appraiser, a qualified umpire, and a clear understanding of the scope and process are really key to navigating the appraisal process effectively when disagreements about value arise.
Yes, it's a valuable tool when used correctly, but it requires careful management.
Now let's move on to the often confusing area of being named as an additional insured on someone else's insurance policy. What exactly does that mean?
Being named as an additional insured AI on an insurance policy, typically the liability policy like a CGL, essentially extends coverage under that policy to parties other than the primary named insured, the one who bought the policy. They get some level of protection under that policy, usually related to the named insured's operations or work for them.
Why is this done?
It's a very common practice in many types of business relationships and contracts. For example, a general contractor might require all subcontractors to name the GC as an additional insured on the sub's liability policy, or a landlord might require a tenant to name the landlord as an AI on the tenant's liability policy. It's a way to transfer risk contractually and have insurance back it up.
But it's getting more complicated.
Yes. The specific details and requirements of additional insured endorsements and the policy language used are increasingly being scrutinized in legal disputes when claims arise. Just having a certificate of insurance saying you're an AI isn't always enough anymore.
What are some important things to understand about these endorsements? What about those blanket endorsements?
You need to be aware of the potential benefits, but also the significant limitations of automatic or blanket additional insured endorsements. These often state that AI status is granted only when required by a written contract. The reading questioned whether these always hold up under scrutiny if the underlying contract isn't perfectly clear or executed properly.
So the contract is key.
Absolutely. Generally, for someone to be properly covered as an additional insured, there usually needs to be a written contract or agreement in place before the loss occurs that specifically and clearly requires one party to be added as an additional insured on the other party's insurance policy. That timing and clarity are critical.
You mentioned a court case, Suffolk Construction.
Right. The case, Suffolk Construction Company, Inc. v. Illinois Union NSCAP, really emphasized this timing aspect. The court ruled that the actual contract formation requiring the additional insured status must happen before the loss occurs, not just the existence of an obligation somewhere to eventually add someone as an additional insured. The agreement needs to be finalized pre-loss.
And there was another scenario mentioned.
Yes. Another real-world example highlighted a situation where a general contractor's claim for additional insured status on a subcontractor's CGL policy was denied because the specific section in their subcontract dealing with insurance requirements was left completely blank. There was no contractual trigger for the AI endorsement.
So a clear, specific written contract that's fully executed before any loss occurs is really crucial for additional insured status to be effective and enforceable. No shortcuts.
Exactly. Attention to contractual detail is paramount when dealing with additional insured requirements.
Now, let's delve into some important aspects of interpreting commercial general liability or CGL insurance policies more broadly. These policies can be complex.
They certainly can be. The reading made an interesting point about how courts should interpret them. It argued that courts should really look at the entire policy document, including all of the definitions, conditions, and exclusions, to get a full understanding of the intended scope of what the main insuring agreement is meant to cover.
As opposed to just looking at the insuring agreement in isolation?
Right. It countered the sometimes stated legal maxim that exclusions do not create coverage. The argument is that while exclusions limit coverage, examining what is excluded can help clarify the intended breadth of the initial grant of coverage in the insuring agreement.
Can you give an example?
The example used was the contractual liability exclusion in a standard CGL policy. This exclusion removes coverage for liability the insured assumes under a contract. However, the exclusion itself has several important exceptions, like for liability the insured would have had anyway, or for certain types of contracts called insured contracts. Looking at these exceptions within the exclusion actually implies that the main insuring agreement is intended to cover some types of liability that the insured assumes under a contract, as long as they fall within those exceptions. So the exclusion helps define the coverage grant.
That's a nuanced way to look at it. Now, there were also some interesting court cases mentioned that explored the definition of accident or occurrence in CGL policies and the related legal concept of fortuity. What's that about?
Fortuity is a fundamental principle in insurance. The idea that insurance is meant to cover accidental, unforeseen events, not losses that are intended or are the natural and probable consequences of deliberate actions. The question is how accidental is defined.
And courts differ on this.
Yes. The reading discussed the Kentucky Supreme Court's decision in Cincinnati Insocy v. Motorists Mutt Insocry. That court took a broader view of what might not be considered an occurrence accident. It incorporated the doctrine of fortuity, which considers whether the event was both unintended and also beyond the power of the insured to control or bring about. They looked at intent and control.
What was their conclusion?
The court essentially concluded that faulty workmanship, for example, while perhaps negligent, might not be considered truly fortuitous or an accident from the contractor's perspective because the work itself was intentional, even if the result was flawed. They stated one cannot intend to commit an accident.
But other courts disagree.
Yes, strongly. The reading highlighted differing interpretations in other states, like Tennessee in Travelers Indem, Company Moore, and Assax, Inc. in Indiana, in Sheehan Kunstler, Comfica, Continental Casco. These courts held that negligent acts, including faulty workmanship that results in unexpected damage to other property, can constitute an accident or occurrence under a CGL policy.
What was their reasoning?
Their reasoning was largely that if only truly unintentional, unexpected acts were covered, the CGL policy would be rendered almost meaningless, as most liability claims arise from some form of negligence in performing intentional acts. They focused on whether the resulting damage was unexpected and unintended, not the act itself.
So a real split in legal interpretation there. What about the role of causation when interpreting CGL policies and their exclusions? There was another case mentioned, Flommerfelt.
Right, the case of Flommerfelt v. Cardiello from New Jersey illustrates the importance of understanding causation, the connection between an excluded activity and the resulting injury when applying exclusions in an insurance policy. This case involved a homeowner's policy exclusion for claims arising out of the use or sale of illegal drugs.
Okay. What happened?
Someone was injured, and the insurer tried to deny coverage based on alleged drug activity at the premises. The court had to interpret the phrase arising out of.
And how did they interpret it?
The court interpreted arising out of to require a close causal and temporal connection between the excluded activity, drug use sale, and the resulting injury. It wasn't enough to show just a general link or a substantial nexus. They required a more direct causal link. The court also importantly considered the reasonable expectations of the insured person when the exclusion language itself might be considered somewhat ambiguous.
So the interpretation of arising out of can be critical.
Absolutely. These differing legal interpretations of fundamental concepts like occurrence, fortuity, and causation arising out of really highlight the potential complexities and jurisdictional differences involved in interpreting CGL and other liability insurance policies. Mm. Even with seemingly standard language, the outcome can vary depending on which state's law applies and which line of case law the court follows.
It definitely shows that even seemingly straightforward policy language can be subject to different legal interpretations, making expert advice even more important. Now, let's take a high-level look at the basic structure and key components of a commercial general liability policy, just to ground ourselves.
Good idea. The CGL policy, while it can be very detailed with endorsements, has a fundamental structure. We should emphasize, as the reading did, that these are high-level explanations and not the sole source for interpreting coverage in a real claim.
Understood. So, coverage A.
The main insuring agreement, known as coverage A, covers bodily injury and property damage liability. It contains the broad promise from the insurer to pay those sums that the insured becomes legally obligated to pay as damages because of bodily injury or property damage to which the insurance applies.
And it has to be caused by an occurrence.
Yes. The bodily injury or property damage must be caused by an occurrence, which is defined in the policy as an accident, including continuous or repeated exposure to substantially the same general harmful conditions. And that occurrence has to take place in the defined coverage territory during the policy period.
And the insurer also defends you.
Yes. Importantly, in addition to paying damages up to the policy limits, the insurer also has a separate duty to defend the insured against any lawsuit seeking damages for bodily injury or property damage that might potentially be covered by the policy, even if the suit is ultimately found to be groundless, false, or fraudulent. The duty to defend is often said to be broader than the duty to pay.
But that broad promise is then cut back.
It's exactly. This broad promise of coverage in the insuring agreement is then significantly limited by numerous exclusions that follow, often starting with the phrase, to which this insurance applies. These exclusions carve out specific types of claims or damages that the policy is not intended to cover.
And there are quite a few important exclusions in coverage A, aren't there? Can you highlight some of the key ones, again, maybe with quick examples?
Sure. Some of the most significant exclusions typically found under coverage A include exclusion A, expected or intended injury, like an employee intentionally punching a customer, no coverage for the assault.
Okay.
Exclusion B, contractual liability. Liability the insured assumes in a contract, though with crucial exceptions for insured contracts and liability you'd have anyway.
Right.
Exclusion C, liquor liability for businesses in the business of serving alcohol, like a tavern over-serving a patron who then causes a car accident. Though watch out for endorsements that might broaden this exclusion to apply even to social hosts.
Important caveat.
Exclusion D, workers' compensation and similar laws. The CGL doesn't cover obligations under workers' comp statutes. Exclusion E, employer's liability, generally excludes bodily injury to an employee arising out of their employment, directing those claims to workers' comp, or separate employer's liability policy again, with some exceptions.
The one from the case study later.
Exactly. Then there's exclusion D, damage to property you own, rent, or occupy. Your CGL covers damage to other people's property, not your own. Exclusion K, damage to your work. excludes property damage to the insured's own work arising out of that work, with a key exception for work done by subcontractors and for completed operations.
That your work exclusion causes lots of construction defect disputes.
Huge area of litigation. Exclusion key, electronic data, clarifies that loss of electronic data is generally not considered tangible property damage covered by the CGL. And exclusion Q, distribution material in violation of statutes, like liability under the Telephone Consumer Protection Act for sending unsolicited advertising, faxes, or texts.
That's a good overview of some major carve-outs. It's important to remember that this is not an exhaustive list, and other exclusions for things like pollution, aircraft, autos, watercraft, war, etc. also apply. Plus, endorsements can add or modify exclusions.
Absolutely. The exclusions define the real boundaries of the coverage.
Now let's walk through that specific case study you mentioned, the one involving the temporary worker versus employee question, and how that impacts both CGL and potentially workers' comp or employer's liability coverage. Set the scene for us again.
Okay. This scenario involves a restaurant called Jez Richard. They sometimes use a temporary staffing agency called Wait With Us, Inc. to provide wait staff during busy periods.
Common practice.
Very. Lisa is one of the temporary workers provided by the agency, Wait With Us. While working at Chez Richard, Lisa is injured. She's burned by boiling water that had been left in a precarious spot near a doorway by Richard, the restaurant owner.
Okay, sounds like potential negligence by the owner. What happens next?
Well, the staffing agency, Wait With Us, Inc., is considered Lisa's direct employer for workers' comp purposes. So they pay Lisa the statutory workers' compensation benefits required by state law, medical bills, some lost wages. Lisa doesn't file a workers' comp claim against Chez Richard.
But she does sue Chez Richard.
Yes. Even though she received workers' comp from the agency, Lisa brings a separate tort lawsuit directly against Chez Richard, alleging negligence on the part of the owner caused her injury. She seeks $500,000 for her pain and suffering, and another $500,000 for her child's alleged loss of consortium due to her injuries, a total of $1 million in the lawsuit.
And Chez Richard's attempt to get the suit dismissed failed.
Right. Their initial motions to dismiss the lawsuit were unsuccessful, meaning the case will proceed toward trial unless settled.
So what was the insurance coverage situation for Chez Richard when they got sued by Lisa? They turned it over to their CGL insurer.
Yes. Chez Richard had a commercial general liability CGL insurance policy, and they submitted the lawsuit to their CGL insurer, expecting the insurer to defend them and potentially pay any judgment or settlement.
But the insurer denied coverage. On what grounds?
The CGL insurer denied coverage for Lisa's lawsuit based on exclusions E, the employer's liability exclusion we just discussed. They took the position that Lisa, despite being provided by a temp agency, was effectively an employee of Chez Richard for the purposes of this exclusion.
But the broker for Chez Richard disagreed.
Yes. Chez Richard's insurance broker argued that Lisa should be classified as a temporary worker according to the specific definition in the CGL policy. And importantly, the CGL definition of employee specifically excludes temporary workers, while it does include leased workers.
Okay, so if she's a temporary worker, she's not an employee, and the exclusion doesn't apply.
That was the broker's argument. If Lisa wasn't an employee as defined, then the employer's liability exclusion shouldn't bar coverage for her tort suit against Chez Richard.
How did the CGL insurer respond to that argument about the temporary worker definition?
The insurer countered by arguing that Lisa's specific work arrangement didn't actually fit the CGL policy's definition of a temporary worker.
What is that definition again?
The definition of temporary worker in the standard CGL form is quite specific. Someone furnished to the insured to substitute for a permanent employee who is on leave, or are, to meet seasonal or short-term peak workloads.
Okay. And the insurer said Lisa didn't fit that.
The insurer argued that perhaps Lisa's work was more ongoing or didn't meet those specific conditions, and therefore she might still be considered either a leased worker, who's included as an employee, or perhaps just a common law employee of Chez Richard based on direction and control, despite the agency involvement. The definitions can be tricky to apply.
So the crucial question here is, given this potential ambiguity in how Lisa's working relationship might be classified under the CGL definitions, could the CGL insurer definitively deny coverage to Chez Richard for Lisa's negligence lawsuit based solely on the employer's liability exclusion? Seems debatable.
It really highlights the potential for inconsistency in dispute. The reading suggests that if an insurer is going to argue that someone is an employee, or leased worker, to invoke a CGL exclusion and deny coverage to the insured business, Chet Richard, it seems potentially inconsistent if that same insurer, or an affiliated workers' comp insurer, might simultaneously argue the person is not an employee for the purposes of providing workers' compensation or employer's liability coverage directly to that worker if a claim were made that way.
Right. They can't have it both ways easily.
It raises questions. The reading concluded that, in this specific scenario, a flat rejection of CGL coverage by Ches Richards' insurer based solely on the employer's liability exclusion might be premature without a very careful fact-specific consideration of the worker's uncertain employment status out of the policy definitions and relevant state law regarding joint employment or borrowed servants.
It really underscores how important it is to clearly define employment relationships in contracts with staffing agencies and to understand exactly how different insurance policies define terms like employee, leased worker, and temporary worker, as the implications for coverage can be significant and unexpected.
Absolutely. It's a good reminder that even seemingly straightforward situations like using temporary staff can have complex and potentially costly insurance coverage implications that need careful thought.
Well, that brings us to the end of this incredibly deep dive into a wide range of insurance topics. We've certainly covered a lot of ground today, from the seemingly simple act of renting a car, all the way to the complex nuances of CGL interpretation and temporary workers. What would you say are a couple of the most significant or broadly applicable insights that our listeners should take away from all of this?
That's a tough choice. We covered so much. But I think two key themes really stand out. First, it's absolutely crucial to look beyond the initial cost or the surface-level assumptions when making insurance decisions. Think about those rental car waivers, seemingly cheap per day, but potentially expensive and redundant.
Mm-hmm.
Or assuming your homeowner's policy covers your side hustle.
Dig deeper.
Right. Don't just assume.
Second, never underestimate the importance of understanding the details, the definitions, the exclusions, the conditions within your policies. Whether it's coinsurance, the definition of flood, the requirements for additional insured status, or what constitutes a business pursuit, the fine print really matters when a claim occurs.
Definitely. And these are insights that really apply to just about everyone, whether you're planning a road trip, running a side business from home, own a condo, hire help, or simply want to be more informed about protecting your financial future and avoiding nasty surprises.
Exactly. It's about managing your personal risk landscape more effectively. So what's the main thing you'd encourage our listener to do after hearing this discussion? What's the call to action?
I would strongly encourage you, the listener, to take a closer, more critical look at your own insurance policies with some of these insights in mind. Don't hesitate to ask your insurance agent or advisor detailed questions about what's covered, what's not covered, and why.
Be an informed consumer.
Yes. Go beyond just the premium cost and really try to understand the protection your policies offer and, just as importantly, the exclusions and limitations they contain. Also, think about some of the non-insurance risk management strategies we discussed today, things you can do proactively to reduce risk, like installing that sump pump or clarifying contracts. Consider which of these areas we touched on, rental cars, home-based businesses, flood insurance, condo coverage, liability gaps, workers' comp for domestic help resonated most with your own situation and might warrant a more in-depth review.
And finally, a thought for you to ponder as we wrap up. Ultimately, insurance is about providing peace of mind, a safety net for the unexpected. What potential blind spots in your current insurance coverage might be quietly causing you concern, or perhaps should be causing you concern now that you've heard this? The world is full of unexpected events, and truly understanding your safety net is the first step in feeling more secure.
Well said. This deep dive has really just scratched the surface of these important and often complex topics, and there's always more to learn. Would encourage you to perhaps look up some of the specific policy forms or concepts we mention online, or better yet, to reach out to a qualified, knowledgeable insurance professional or personal risk manager for advice tailored specifically to your individual needs and circumstances.
Great advice. Thanks for navigating us through all that complex material today.
My pleasure. Hopefully it was helpful for you listening.